Hello, welcome to episode 12 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty, a podcast created by my writing partner Nick Petru and I, Patrick McCarthy. We will be immersing ourselves in the world of the written words and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respects to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region and their leaders, past, present, and emerging. How the fuck are you, Nick?
Excellent, man. You did that off the top of your head as well. That was amazing. Cheers to that.
I've been doing that for weeks.
No, you've been looking at your little notepad, I swear.
No, I've been doing that for weeks, yeah.
I just don't really pay attention to you.
Oh, fair enough. We are together a lot.
And we're going to be together a lot more now because I have officially moved into Frio. Yes! Yeah. Yeah, so if the recording quality is terrible right now, it's because we haven't really set up soundproofing because we had such a professional setup at the previous place.
The laundry room.
Yeah, it might be a little bit echoey and whatnot, but we'll soon get room dividers and figure all of that shit out.
The laundry room had beautiful acoustics.
It really did. Yeah.
These acoustics are untested.
No, they are.
Albeit it's a beautiful, beautiful home, man. You absolutely nailed it.
Yeah, for those listening, it's a little like studio apartment, like a single room with a balcony and a bathroom / toilet, and it's just great.
You come in here, you come into Nick's new place, and you go, yeah, Nick's a pimp.
We're going to do something a little bit different today in that the story we're beginning with is quite long. Probably about twice the length of the longest story that we've had on the podcast so far. So yeah, I think we'll just get straight into it.
Sure, yeah. And then I've written a poem and we've also got a little like book review later on. Instead of an essay, I'm just going to like talk about a novel I really, really appreciate. And yeah. I guess I can recommend to any listeners who have never even heard of it. You know, a lot of people seem to have never even fucking heard of this novel and it's a genuine masterpiece.
Is it one of the Goosebumps books?
It is, yeah. R.L. Stine's masterpiece, yeah. But no, it's fucking whack, but I think people will enjoy it.
And yeah, before we begin, that story that I was talking about, Embryo, was previously published by Quill and Crow in one of their anthologies.
Quill and Crow. That's a very nice name.
It is. Gothic AF.
For sure. Yeah, that's the Edgar Allan Poe as fuck. You love that.
I do.
Embryo by Nick Petru. An hour before the church abducted Calvin Morgan, he had been on his way home from the asylum and had asked his coachman to drop him off at a pub instead of taking him to his front door. On this occasion, his coachman delivered him to one of London's many King's Arms. He nursed a black beer at a table towards the back, beyond the reach of the gas lamps, numbing himself in preparation for his wife and unborn child. For the latter's arrival, he was less than enthused. Indeed, and while he had only admitted it to his comrade, Dr. Shaw, the thought of ending the pregnancy had entered Calvin's mind on more than one occasion, especially when his wife coerced him into discussing names. To name something was to make it real, to give it power. After he had finished his beer, Calvin began his usual meander home, breathing into his hands like his fingers were kindling. A drizzle varnished the cobblestone streets, and the air reeked of sulphur. He had scarcely made it around the first corner when a carriage powered by two bat-black horses pulled up alongside him. The door flew open, and a sizable man in a cassock addressed him as Dr. Morgan, before hoisting him into the carriage like he weighed no more than the sum of his boots and coat. He perceived little after that, mostly just the stench of some sweet-smelling chemical, and when he finally came to consciousness, he was chained to the stone tiles of a crypt. Calvin's first thought was to scream which he did, until a clergyman stepped out of the darkness, arms folded behind his back. By the clergyman's stature alone, he knew he was not the man who had plucked him from the street. This man's features were shadowed, as though his skull was sucking in his face. "There is no use in howling, Doctor," said the clergyman. Calvin howled anyway, but it was brought to a violent end when a second clergyman stepped out of the darkness and booted his ribs, leaving him gasping for air. This clergyman was of a build that Calvin likened to his abductor. His broad shoulders supported a large, bald head with a wax-like sheen. "Ah, you have met Father Roland," said the older clergyman, nodding at his bold companion. "He is my eye, and my fist, if need be. I am the vicar of this parish, to which you are now in service. You will soon beg to begin your work, I am sure, but you must understand, Doctor, is that if you should try to escape, or fail to sustain it, we will bury you so deep that not even God could find you." Calvin managed a syllable before his skull exploded and everything went black. The ensuing days were not so much a test of Calvin's body as his mind. To an extent, he could bear Father Roland's fists as well as the friction of the iron shackles, but the boredom was the rack, the thumbscrew. From his corner, which was lit by a single gas lamp above his head, Calvin could only see a short distance into the crypt. It consisted of a single room with a vaulted ceiling of naked stone bricks supported by an array of columns. Running down the center of the ceiling into the darkness was a bundle of copper pipes to which his gas lamp connected. As far as Calvin could tell, the crypt's recesses no longer housed sarcophagi or coffins, and while the air was musty, there was also a chemical undertone that reminded him of his laboratory back at the asylum. The only other notable feature that he could see was the double door through which Father Roland came and went. The door's timbers were swollen against its iron straps, and whenever the clergyman opened or closed the door, its shriek echoed through the crypt as if through a canyon. Calvin endured four of Father Roland's visits before he stopped demanding his immediate release and actually listened to the clergyman, who, upon entry, had said, "My knuckles are raw, Dr. Morgan. We'll soon resort to other means, if we must." Calvin was standing against the wall, hugging his face with his forearms. "No, wait, he said, bottom lip splitting open, blood tasting like coins in his mouth. What do you want? Father Roland's fists unfurled into chubby fingers and palms. "Well, I'll show you, Dr. Morgan. But try anything stupid, and I'll beat your face shut." Calvin slowly lowered his guard. "You'll unshackle me?" Father Roland nodded, his neck fat bulging over his collar. He produced a key as he approached Calvin, whose eyebrows were level with the clergyman's top button. When the chain and shackles clattered to the floor, Calvin said, "Obliged," and started rotating the feeling back into his hands. Reversing a few steps, Father Roland reached behind a nearby column, picked up a gas lantern and lit it. Then he motioned Calvin to walk ahead, and the two men followed a hemisphere of golden lamplight down the crypt's central aisle. The chemical scent that Calvin had previously noted grew stronger, and he soon beheld its source. Built into the back of the crypt, around a stone altar and inside of six of the crypt's rearmost recesses, was a laboratory, as well as something behind the altar, which the lantern had yet to reach. As for the laboratory, it was well equipped, all things considered, exhibiting a range of scientific instruments, including but by no means limited to beakers, syringes, alembics, scales, and microscopes. One recess contained a bookshelf packed with leather-bound tomes. Filling a shelving unit opposite the bookshelf were jars and tanks containing urine-yellow preservation fluid and organs which were of particular interest to Calvin. Brains, spinal cords, and other configurations of the human nervous system. Father Roland went to a panel on the wall and brought the laboratory to light. Behind the altar, in an area the size of a modest living room, there were eight tall copper tanks, which fed by way of copper pipes into a glass tank to the front and center. The central tank was cylindrical and reinforced with copper rods that connected the tank's lid to its base, which was made of copper and fitted with valve wheels, gauges, and other controls and dials. The glass contained a nectar-like orange fluid, and what floated in it, hitched to several tubes, was something that at once confused and disgusted Calvin. He braced himself against the altar, which was littered with half-gutted notebooks and loose sheets of paper. "My God, what is it?" "Your life, Dr. Morgan," said Father Roland, stepping up to Calvin's side. "You'll feed it and make sure it grows." "I don't even know what it is. I work at an asylum and I research neuroregeneration when time and funding permit it. What can I possibly know about that?" "No," said the clergyman.
"What?"
"You studied at Ingolstadt. Medicine, biology, chemistry." Calvin's expression had yet to shift from one of utter confusion, but now he directed it at the clergyman. "Read Dr. Hill's notes and you'll understand why we need a brain doctor." "A neurologist," Calvin corrected him.
"And who is Dr. Hill?"
"Well, he's who you'll be if you don't get to work."
"What?"
"Dead, Mr. Morgan. Dead." Over the next 3 days, Calvin worked to decipher Dr. Hill's notes while trying to stay clear-headed in the presence of what Hill had simply referred to as the embryo. In describing the creature, modern taxonomy had proved insufficient. Dr. Hill had assigned it to the animal kingdom, but he had been unable to settle on a phylum. Calvin's best guess was Mollusca, with Arthropoda at a close second. Either way, both doctors agreed that the creature had been designed for a subaqueous existence, as it lacked the hard structural tissue it might require to maintain a shape when subjected to the planet's gravity. Dr. Hill was even so bold to suggest that the creature might thrive in the vacuum of space, which Calvin dismissed as lunacy, along with Hill's other ramblings. With consideration to his more immediate concerns, namely keeping the embryo alive, Calvin gleaned some critical details from Dr. Hill's work. For instance, the various copper tanks were life support systems, replacing the maternal faculties of whatever god-awful creature the embryo had been removed from, a subject on which the church seemed to have kept Dr. Hill intentionally unenlightened. Among such systems was a feeding apparatus composed of a funnel, some copper pipes, three valves, and two organic tubes which Dr. Hill had synthesized himself, a feat for which the late doctor regained some of Calvin's respect. The substance the embryo was suspended in was also artificial, fulfilling the role of amniotic fluid, as well as, in Dr. Hill's words, serving as the medium for the vicar's containment spell. Calvin wondered what Hill might have done to incur the vicar's wrath, as he had quite literally transcended the bounds of modern science to satiate the embryo. He knew it could not have been Hill's talk of the occult, for he sensed that the clergymen of this particular parish, whichever parish it was, were more than disposed towards such nonsense. Continuing with Hill's notes on the subject of feeding, it became clear to Calvin why he, and not some other physician, had been chosen. The embryo subsisted solely on brains, of which the human variety yielded the greatest results. Calvin could think of no other creature in all the world with such an abominable diet. Grasping at least the basics, Calvin picked up where Dr. Hill had left off, using his spare time to ingest more of the late doctor's notes, tend to the wounds Father Roland had gifted him, and plot his escape. His pregnant wife hardly crossed his mind. Reading about the embryo was one thing, but Calvin found that as he physically neared the wretch, its presence pressed harder and harder upon him, causing him to vomit when he came within arm's reach of its tank. Despite a lack of sensory organs, and although it had no face, Calvin often felt he had the embryo's undivided attention. An attention that, as Hill agreed, suggested intelligence, even cunning. Calvin, however, could not bring himself to agree with Dr. Hill's conclusion that the embryo was objectively a thing of evil, summoned by devil-worshipping cultists who have infiltrated the Church of England. Staring at the knotted mass of cornflower blue flesh via its reflection in a well-polished copper tank, Calvin shuddered. Then he set about feeding the creature. In one of the recesses near the altar, there was a large icebox that housed beakers of human brain tissue and whole brains, one exhibiting signs of acute neurodegeneration. Calvin brought one of the healthier brains to a mortar and pestle by the sink. When he was done, he poured the pulp into a copper bowl and brought it over to the embryo's tank. Somewhere inside the base of the tank, the main copper pipe of the feeding apparatus connected to one of Dr. Hill's organic tubes, which in turn connected to the embryo, like an umbilical cord. Calvin emptied the bowl into the funnel. He tightened a small valve wheel where the funnel connected to the main copper pipe, then he grimaced at the embryo's flaccid, tendril-like appendages, of which there were 12. "Glut yourself then, filth," he said, loosening the main valve wheel and flushing the copper pipe into the umbilical cord. The embryo pulsated as it fed. Next, he checked one of the tank's many gauges, reading the weight of its contents and recording it in a table he had drawn up in a fresh notebook. Since Dr. Hill's retirement a little over a week ago, The embryo hadn't grown all that much, remaining about the size of a newborn human baby. But Calvin did note some penny-sized lumps toward the top of the creature's bulk, which had so far gone unnoticed. Over the next hour, he monitored the creature's heart rate, blood pressure, nutrient levels, and a range of other attributes, the last being its sensitivity to light, of which it had none. By then, the embryo had passed much of its meal, so Calvin emptied its waste tank into a bucket, vomited into that same bucket, then washed the steaming heap down the sink with water from a hand pump. Soon after, Calvin went to his narrow bed, which had been set up in one of the recesses where the dead had once slept. Father Roland entered the crypt. As Calvin had previously noted, the clergyman always locked the door behind him and always stuffed the key into his right-hand pocket. Father Roland went to the altar, scanned the laboratory, then stood over Calvin, who was now sitting on the edge of the bed. After several long seconds, Calvin pursed his lips and said, "Dr. Hill believes the creature is some sort of demon." At the word demon, Father Roland swept the back of his left hand across Calvin's face, sending him to the floor. "Believed," corrected the clergyman, "and you'll do best not to speak of demons." His face looked especially waxen, melted even, where he stood in front of one of the dustier gas lamps. "What is it then?" said Calvin. "Why am I doing this?" The clergyman frowned thoughtfully. "You don't need to know." Calvin climbed to his feet, both palms raised in defense, back pressed against the wall. "You're not sure yourself, are you? The vicar hasn't told you everything." Father Roland lifted his left hand to his face and inspected the lesions upon his middle knuckle, which had become infected and was now oozing blood and pus. "I know it is of God," he said, "and that we do God's work." Calvin lowered his guard. "If you would retrieve some coal tar, Father, I could extract from it an acid that might quell your affliction." The clergyman grunted and then left the crypt, leaving Calvin to wrestle with sleep. In Calvin's dreams, he saw his wife splayed over their bed, her skin as grey as the smog shrouding the window. The mattress held her blood like a sponge, as wet and red as a slab of raw mutton. Trailing out between her legs was an umbilical cord, though attached to it was no human baby, but that blasted embryo. The walls of the crypt screamed back at Calvin as he woke in a sweat. In the early hours of the next morning, Calvin got out of bed and inspected the lock mechanism on the double door, as he had done each morning prior. Then he tested it with a pair of lockpicks he had fashioned from tweezers. But he was no rogue, and his efforts served only to frustrate him. Next, he attempted, using a small hammer, to knock the pins out of the door hinges, but they were of some castle-grade robustness, and he gave up when his once controlled blows started causing a racket. He would have to find a way to weaken the door, slip out as someone entered, or snatch the key from Father Roland. He knew, however, that trying to overpower that brick chimney of a man was no sane option. Unable to go back to sleep, Calvin turned on the laboratory lights and stood in front of the embryo, only mildly nauseated by its presence now. Looking at the lumps toward the top of the creature's bulk, Calvin swore they had gotten bigger. He left and came back with a magnifying glass, confirming his observation. After he recorded the change in his notebook, he conducted some general laboratory maintenance, it being far too early to feed the embryo. He lubricated a few valve wheels, polished every glass surface, and then assessed his inventory. Opening the icebox, a cold cloud wafted out and reminded him of Dr. Shaw's research in the field of cryogenics, during which he had successfully solidified carbon dioxide gas. Calvin took note of this too, but only in his mind. Finishing in the laboratory, Calvin realized he reeked of a beggar. The apron, shirt, and trousers Father Roland had provided him were smeared with grease. He filled a bucket with water from the sink, took off his clothes, and scrubbed the gunk out of his corners and creases. Then he took a scalpel to his face and shaved, removing all but his side whiskers. He didn't know how long he would be here, and maintaining one's hygiene is vital to maintaining one's sanity and morale. That evening, while emptying the embryo's waste tank, Calvin managed not to vomit. As the doctor was pouring some of the waste into a beaker, because he had thought it best to store a sample for later analysis, Father Roland entered the crypt, a lantern in one hand and a large brown bottle in the other. The clergyman's nose twitched as he walked into the laboratory. He put the bottle down beside the sink with just shy of enough force to shatter it. Coal tar. After spending the next morning extracting carbolic acid crystals from the coal tar, Calvin made them up in a liquid solution and bottled it. Then he tended to his regular duties, taking notes with an almost mechanical detachment. When he shone a magnified lantern upon the embryo, however, testing its sensitivity to light, he became conscious all at once, for the embryo shuddered in reaction to the stimulus. Pressing his beakish nose against the tank, Calvin saw that those penny-sized lumps had, overnight, developed a distinct texture. Circling the tank, he observed that all 12 lumps were still arranged in a circle, like a halo. Then he studied them through a magnifying glass, concluding that they all exhibited the same pattern, a hexagonal lattice. The embryo had developed compound eyes. It could see. Calvin did not even gag when he emptied the waste tank that evening. He replaced a length of copper piping and polished the embryo's tank where he had pressed his nose against the glass, working the same spot in a tight, feverish circle as he peered into the creature's unblinking eyes, contemplating its thoughts, not from a scientific perspective, but an emotional one. Indeed, the longer Calvin stared at the creature, the more and more logical thought he lost to passion, as though he was 6 pints down, but without the grogginess. Was the embryo afraid? Did it believe it was cared for? Was it even aware he existed? Calvin carried such questions to bed with him that night, during which a thunderstorm vibrated the walls. When he finally fell asleep, he dreamed he was sitting on the edge of his bed in his apartment in London, rocking the embryo in a blanket in his arms, his wife dead on the mattress behind him. Roland half leaned, half sat against the altar while Calvin inspected the clergyman's massive hand, concluding that the knuckle had healed over well. "You will survive, Roland," he said.
"Obliged," said Roland, rotating his hand in front of his face.
Then he turned away from the altar, so he faced the embryo, which had grown by almost 50% in the weeks since it had sprouted compound eyes.
"The vicar is pleased, Dr. Morgan."
Despite Calvin's situation, which had certainly improved but was still not agreeable, he felt a familiar pride swell through him, inflating his chest. Well, while the other components of the brain might sustain the embryo, they retard its ability to digest the hippocampus and amygdala, of which its diet now solely consists. Roland rubbed his topmost chin.
"You learned all that from its shite."
Calvin, who was now flicking through a notebook on the altar, said,
"Somewhat, yes."
After half a minute of silence in which Roland had not stopped staring at the embryo, the clergyman said,
"Shouldn't we name it?"
"What?"
"Well, I was thinking it would be easier if it had a name."
Calvin set down the notebook and followed Roland's gaze. Then he shook his head dismissively and looked down at the altar, allowing his vision to blur. "I assume that if you could procure coal tar, you could procure other materials too."
"Something with a W, maybe," said Roland. "What about Walter?"
Calvin let out a frustrated sigh.
"Can you get them, Roland?"
Roland blinked himself back into the moment.
"What sorts of materials?"
Let me explain," said Calvin. He paused for effect, then continued. "One of my academic peers, who I met in Germany, Dr. Shaw, delved deeper into the atom, while I, much to Shaw's displeasure, altered my course to become a brain doctor."
"Neurologist," said Roland.
Calvin couldn't help but smile. "Shaw succeeded in transmuting carbon dioxide gas into solid carbon dioxide, yet due to internal politics, his work has been largely suppressed. This material would be of great use to us here, Roland. We could freeze tissue more efficiently, render certain storage tanks inert for maintenance purposes, and seize piping in emergency situations. The material has medical applications too, of course, such as banishing warts and skin imperfections." Roland looked down at his lap.
"Warts, you say?
If I tell you where to find Dr. Shaw, will you get it? He works in London."
"And I suppose you want me to tell him where we're holding you too, eh?"
Calvin chuckled. "Better yet, go straight to the runners." After Calvin had attacked a fresh batch of cadavers with a bone saw, working for the church, the dead were in no short supply. He removed the hippocampi and amygdalas, then ground just enough of them to feed the embryo, whose appetite was growing. Approaching the tank, he felt no sickness at all, only the tug of responsibility, which it always pleased him to satisfy. While he was checking the valve wheels, he noticed movement out of the corner of his eye. One of the embryo's 12 tendrils was swimming, eel-like, against the glass, aimed in Calvin's direction. Calvin walked back and forth in a crescent around the tank, and the tendril followed him. Placing his hand upon the glass, the tendril crumpled itself into his palm. Calvin's triumphant shouting echoed through the crypt,
cheering him on like a crowd. He diluted some ethanol in a test tube and took a shot, then spent the rest of the night dancing about the embryo's tank, and when he finally went to bed, he did not think to remove his greasy, bloody apron. In his dreams, his wife had risen from death, and they held their cornflower blue baby between them in their arms, its tendrils writhing as they kissed and tickled its vein-strewn bulk. 3 days after the embryo had first moved, Roland wheeled a small icebox into the crypt, finding Calvin standing an inch from the tank, hair in a matted shock. "Your friend Dr. Shaw is quite the eccentric," Roland said as he pushed the icebox into one of the empty recesses near the back. Calvin didn't move. "Dr. Morgan?" Calvin cocked his head. "Yes?" "The dry ice?" "Ah, yes." Calvin peeled himself away from the glass and went to Roland. As Calvin opened the icebox, a chalky mist tumbled out, erasing both men from the knees down. He shut the icebox and nodded at the clergyman. Roland shuffled on the spot. "You said something about warts, Dr. Morgan." Calvin looked down at Roland's crotch, then back at the clergyman's reddening face. "You'll need to remove your cassock, Father, if I'm to take a look." Thumbs wrestling, Roland reversed a few steps. "There's a service in the church in 1 hour. I'm on the organ. I have to get ready." Calvin grinned. "It's not like I'm going anywhere." For the next 3/4 of an hour, Calvin tended to his usual duties, pausing every so often to engage with the embryo, encouraging it to chase him around the tank with its tendrils, of which it can now operate all 12. Throughout the next 10 minutes after that, Calvin's heart beat faster and faster, until he could bear it no more and leapt up from where he'd been sitting against the embryo's tank to execute his plan. First, he filled a ceramic pitcher with ethanol. Then he took a few dozen chunks of carbon dioxide from the icebox with a pair of tongs, dropping them into a second pitcher. Before he put on a pair of gloves, he pocketed the small hammer he had used for this same purpose in the past. Then he carefully crossed the crypt with both pitchers in hand, setting them down in front of the double door, which he pressed one ear to. A minute later, he heard the muffled piping of a church organ. Peering back down the central aisle of the crypt, he waved farewell to the embryo, whose tendrils were slithering more frantically by the second. Calvin sighed. Then he emptied the pitcher of ethanol into the pitcher of dry ice. A thick mist rolled over Calvin's gloves as he poured the super cold liquid over the lower right-hand door hinge. As it touched the metal, a shrill whistling pierced his skull. But if the metal was contracting, Calvin couldn't see it. He emptied half the pitcher, then set it down and took out the hammer. He went to his knees and started striking the bottom of the hinge, trying to knock the pin out of the top. His frustration building, he started smashing the hinge at random, hoping it would just split in two. To no avail. He put one ear to the door again and could still hear the organ playing. Pouring the rest of the liquid over the hinge, he went at it again, but his bones shivered with each strike and frustration seized him once more. When he had all but worn the flesh from his palm, he fell with his back against the door. Glancing at the hinge out at the corner of his eye, his logical mind told him that while it may have only moved a fraction, the pin had moved, and one more picture might do it. But looking back at the embryo down the shadowed length of the crypt, its tendrils sinking in defeat, Calvin was not listening to logic. The dry ice had failed. He would need to bide his time and come up with another plan. How long that took, it didn't matter. A month later, on the first day of spring, Walter tore his umbilical cord out of his purpling bulk, opting instead to suck his meals straight out of the cord using the tiny mouths he could spawn, and also retract anywhere on his body in an instant. Rather than gaining color, Calvin lost all of his. Midway through June, Walter started bobbing up and down and rotating in his tank, having removed all of his tubes except the one which carried away his waste. Calvin ran in circles around the tank, dizzying himself while Walter conveyed his joy by blowing bubbles. Calvin introduced toys too, like sock puppets, balls of putty, and a lidless skull. In July, the clergy started building an indoor pool somewhere near the church, all while Calvin considered the actual logistics of moving Walter. By autumn, Calvin could no longer see his mouth through his beard. When Walter started trying to remove the lid from his tank, Calvin had to force himself not to take out a stepladder and help Walter escape. That night, he fed Walter whole hippocampi and amygdalas before eating an uncooked amygdala himself. With winter a day away, Roland snuck Calvin a bottle of beer with his standard ration of an egg and two slices of bread, as well as a beer for himself. While the men enjoyed their beverages, Walter compressed his bulk against the back of the tank, then launched himself forwards, cracking the glass. "It broke," said Calvin, shaking Roland by the shoulders. "It broke." Roland lumbered away with considerable speed, leaving the double door wide open as he ascended a stone flight and vanished from Calvin's view. Calvin started running, but not towards the door. He wrapped his arm around Walter's tank, and Walter thrust his bulk against the glass, bubbles escaping his many mouths in violent bursts. "Not yet, Walter," said Calvin. "Your new home is not quite ready." "Not yet, my child." "Not yet, not yet." Via the reflection in the glass, Calvin saw the vicar approaching him, with Roland a few steps behind. As Calvin turned to face the vicar, the vicar's lips peeled away from his yellowing teeth. "Seize him," he said. Roland looked at Calvin, then back at the vicar, who repeated his instruction in a crackling tone that started Roland into immediate action. "Seize him!" As Roland tore Calvin away from the tank, Calvin screamed, clawing trenches into the clergyman's forearms and hands. Roland took it without complaint, dragging Calvin to the vicar's feet, then pinning him to the floor with his boot. With even just a fraction of Roland's weight upon his spine, Calvin quickly realized his struggle was pointless. He also understood that Roland was going easy on him. He tried to relax. Arms folded behind his back, the vicar approached the altar, blocking Calvin's view of the tank. Facing away from the other men, the vicar said, "Oh, marvellous, Doctor. Just marvellous. You have done a great service to the church, to God, to England, which shall finally be purged. Now, what better reward than to enter the kingdom of heaven, a saint? For you must know that nothing of what we have done here can leave this place. Not yet. Not until it cannot be undone. Father Roland, show the good doctor to our God." Calvin's brain bounced back and forth in his skull, and all went black. When Calvin woke on the footpath around the corner from the King's Arms, head throbbing, hair clotted with blood, he could remember just two things that had happened after Roland had knocked him out. The first was Roland himself, loading him into the same carriage he had used to abduct him. Roland must have noticed Calvin's eyes open a crack, for he paused to say, "I'm supposed to take you to the woods and bury you, Dr. Morgan. Don't come looking for us. Cross the channel if you can. Dr. Rill may have been right." Then he shut the door on him. The second thing Calvin remembered, clearly occurring before the first, was the birth. Calvin had watched the vicar raise his arms in exultation as glass and amniotic fluid crashed to the floor. Then, hovering over the altar, suspended by some unseeable force, he saw Walter. Like the shadow of a looming thundercloud, Walter grew, his tendrils swelling in both length and girth and coiling around the columns, his bulk bubbling outwards, flooding the ceiling vaults and sprouting 100 mouths in a matter of seconds. His expansion was deafening, a clacking of teeth, a sporadic squelching, a rhythmic piping. His reek was sweet and awful, and Calvin could not breathe enough of it. Walter tensed his tendrils, wringing several columns to dust. The crypt shuddered. A section of the brick roof crashed down next to Roland, whose eyes were wide and jowls were trembling. The vicar bellowed a command in a language unknown to Calvin, and Walter recoiled. Then, with what seemed a tremendous effort, he hurled two tendrils straight at the vicar. But before they reached the clergyman, they crumpled as though they had struck a glass wall. And the vicar cackled. Then he launched a verbal barrage, beating Walter into a manageable shape, binding him with invisible chains. Soon, all of Walter's mouths and tendrils hung limp, his racket hushed. The vicar approached Walter's veiny, sweltering bulk as Walter descended from the ceiling. He placed one palm upon him and said, "I christen thee the second son of Almighty God." With such thoughts in his mind, Calvin now stumbled through the nighttime city, his breath billowing out of his throat in thick clouds, his stench frightening passers-by to whom he clung and cried, "The carriage that delivered me, have you seen it? Where did it go? Where is Father Roland? Where is the church? Where? Where?" He went from gas lamp to gas lamp, crossing the busy streets without checking for carriages under whose wheels and hooves he was nearly pulverized on more occasions than one. He was branded a drunken vagrant and mugged for the air in his pockets. And when his excitement tapered, allowing the winter night to take hold of his bones, he curled up on a pile of moldy sacks in an alley and wept until he thought he would die from shivering. As the sky began to grey, he clambered to his feet. Arms folded over his belly, he let his body carry him wherever it wanted to go, saying Walter's name over and over in his head, "Walter, Walter," until the words started to come out with his stuttering breath. "Walter, Walter." Soon enough, he arrived at the front steps of his apartment, the first pale yellow rays of dawn piercing the smog to illuminate a face that had not seen sunlight in months. He struck the door knocker, and while he waited for his wife to answer, he thought about what he would say next time she coerced him into discussing potential names for their unborn child. But he did not have to think for long. If his wife bore a son, they would name him Walter. The end. All right, man. So, like, what was that about?
There's a lot to unpack there, actually. So much was going through my mind in that fucking hour we took to record that thing. I think it was around, 5,000 or 6,000 words, so...
Yeah.
Not sure if we'll be doing something that long again anytime soon, but we'll see. Okay, so I really wanted to get into my research for that one, and I did. I wanted to set it, I think it was around, early... It was, 1700s or 1800s London, so I, put a fair bit of time into researching the technologies and terminologies that they were using at the time to try and give it a bit more
authenticity.
That's the one. So that in that way, it was really fun for me. And I also wanted to write something that sort of followed the trajectory of Bloodborne, where it started off quite gothic and then it kind of went into the Lovecraftian, which it kind of does at the end of that story there.
Like some sort of strange cosmic horror.
That's it. And that sort of progression, I wanted to dabble with that on my own. And I also, looking back on the story, given what's happened since writing it, and bear in mind this was 2 years ago, there's a few themes that subliminally, say the word for me.
Subliminally?
Subliminally. I can't say it. a few themes.
Beneath the surface.
Yeah. Beneath the surface themes that maybe I didn't really realize I was writing about when I wrote that. Or realize at least what they meant to me. So,
what?
So, for instance, Calvin not wanting to have kids, being completely freaked out by the thought. And then, obviously throughout the story, he grows to care for this creature. And that's
Walter.
Yeah, Walter. and that's the thing that kind of sets him up to want to be a father. So that's the sort of journey that he had to go through to decide, yes, no, I want to have children.
Personally, that was my favorite part of the story. This slow and really, really decrepit realization that he wants to be a father, but in this horrific context. I just thought that was perfectly twisted.
Oh, thanks.
Especially through that Bloodborne vein. And it calls back to our first episode where we talked about Bloodborne. People were probably like, what the fuck is this game? But we are really obsessed about that kind of gothic and cosmic horror fusion and things like tentacles and slime and unholy emotions.
Yeah.
Borning out of your subconscious and taking hold of you.
Corrupted churches.
Yeah.
And just, I love that. And the priest is a wizard, but like a dark magician. I love that sort of vibe.
Yeah.
I just try to come up with really creepy accents for them as well.
Yeah, no, you did good with the accents. I was quite happy with that.
Yeah, I imagine people who actually speak with those accents are probably like, "Twat, you're a cunt." Yeah, yeah. But like, I love doing that. I think after the bunyip, I really want to get more into voice acting. Yeah, it's really, really fun.
But yeah, returning to that main theme there, when I wrote that story, I remember drafting maybe like 3 or 4 stories for this anthology deadline that was coming up, and scrapping 90% of the material each time, like I rewrote the story. And the story that we ended up with was nothing like the first one I wrote, except for the character's name and a few other like minor aspects. I was really, really struggling because I was going through like a bit of a rough patch with Sarah at the time. She ended up like moving out. And I just remember going completely mad in my living, like, no, sorry, in my office, in the laundry, going completely mad. And I was like, I want the character to reflect that. And I also want the story, I think, well, this is maybe what I didn't understand at that time. I also want the story to reflect that problem Sarah and I were going through, which is the whole, do I want to have children thing? Like she does. I didn't want to. Yeah. And now we've kind of come like full circle. Now we've completely separated, and now I'm in my own place in Fremantle, and she's about to move into a place around Mount Lawley area. And it's all because of that conversation, that inevitable speed bump. You know, everything else in the relationship could work, but the fact that I didn't want to have kids, or at least don't know if I want to or when I'm going to want to, and the fact that she did, that split us apart. And it's just nuts that I was writing about that 2 years ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's like you were doing the healthy writer thing, which is, I guess, exercising certain demons through your craft. In this case, like, bearing actual demons, you know, to the forefront. But yeah, man, I reckon, I mean, like, especially in your vein, that must have been like a very, very important experience.
Well, that story means a lot to me on that level, and also because it was because I just put so much bloody effort into it. I tried so hard to get that publication and I got it. And the story is flawed in many ways. The prose is weak in many aspects. Like, I do a little bit of overwriting from time to time, and I feel like where I needed to be a little bit more clear with the action and all of that, I wasn't. And also what you said earlier about how I was injecting that sort of historical research that I did probably like too often throughout the story. Whereas if I could have just kind of like set that up at the beginning and just been like, all right, look, this is the time and this is the setting and all of that, and now we're just going to focus on the characters and the story, I was just kind of like jamming, like shoehorning the science in and shoehorning the setting in.
Which is understandable, though. Much, I mean, yeah. You hadn't done anything of this scale, I presume, and you wanted to be really involving, you wanted to really evoke that proposed time period in historical context.
Yeah.
I guess that shows, like, your growing confidence as a writer, is that, like, you can acknowledge that maybe, you know, I guess that the flaws of the writing of it, but still take pride in the fact that you did it, and you did it for an emotional reason, and it can give you great purpose in writing something similar to that, because I know for a fact you're never going to fucking leave that gothic cosmic prison ever. Like, never. You know, you're a real slimy fuckwit. but yeah, no, I really, really enjoyed reading that out.
Let's get on to a poem, or do you want to do the book?
And now we'll do the poem, man. It's definitely, it's fresh in my mind. Hey, I felt a little bit like Calvin the last couple of weeks. I wrote this poem because I've been struggling with a bit of purpose, and a bit of, and maybe struggling with the weight of certain responsibilities that have only come up in the last few weeks. Usually I feel very, very confident in how I go about life, but just the last, maybe this last 3 weeks, I just felt a little bit overwhelmed by the things that are coming at me. So, and I was really struggling creatively. We've had certain weeks off the podcast where we have a lot of turbulence in our lives at the moment, you know, breakups and moving house. And I wrote this poem just to try and reflect my psyche as it is currently.
Well, it comes back to what I was saying before. It's like, okay, people didn't really start creating art and stuff like that until they had the comfort to do so. Like, if you just have to think about like shelter and food and water, and that's all you've got the time for, because if you don't do it, you're going to die. You don't have time to think about fucking doing a cave painting or writing a book or whatever it is. So it's like, you've got stresses in your life that are like using up most of your brain at the moment. And therefore you can't create. I think you need a certain level of comfort to create. Some people, but I also think you need a level of pressure. You need experience to like, you know, have things to write about.
Definitely.
So don't be too hard on yourself. You know, right now, think of it as research. You're gaining experience for your next poem or your next story or whatever it is.
So this poem is called A Break from Being Myself. by Patrick McCarthy. Everything I will ever see and all the things I will ever be are fantasies of only me and all I've come to understand. But I need a break from being myself to somehow try another's hand. I do believe it would be fun to be some other parent's son or daughter. Frankly, anyone, just someone else for a day. Because I need a break from being myself to experience what others may. How differently they'd take on life, how brazenly they'd combat strife, navigate a world cruelly rife with misfortune at every turn. Might I get a break from being myself, just to see how others have learned? I'm strong in some specific ways, but rampant faults drive me to craze, exhausted, lost, amidst a maze. In me flaws and weakness abound. And perhaps a break from being myself would help me for once stand my ground. To find some fight and strength in pain. To stop driving lovers insane with insecurities maintained through the years like perverse delights. Fucking give me a break from being myself. A chance at enjoying some light. To stand up tall when life attacks, absorb its blows and take a crack at keeping one's whole world intact and my dear ones feeling dear. But I can't take a break from being myself because I'm the only one here. Thanks.
Edgy as fuck, bro.
Edgy, eh? Yeah, no, I felt I was channeling my Blink 182.
I quite liked it, though.
Thanks, man.
Do you feel better?
I do, yeah, I did. I feel much better after writing that, you know? Like, I told you, I was trying to write another poem for maybe like a couple weeks, and I got really close to like ascertaining some sort of theme, but it was just so cluttered. Like, it, you know, when you're just trying to spin too many plates. Mm. I feel like all the best things I've ever written, they might be like maybe complex in structure, or they might be difficult to write in terms of keeping up some sort of consistency and maybe imagery and trying to evoke some sort of emotion. But the theme is always super clear, like super simple. And I just couldn't grasp at it. And once I changed my focus, because I have a list of poems I want to write, like, and themes I want to explore. That one, just like, I was describing it to Alexandra. And I described that one, she said, with like a little bit more verve. Maybe that this philosophical outlook of wanting a break from just being who you are. Like, you're always Nick, right? And like, yeah, you're always you, and your identity is necessary. You know, it's vital for you to function. It's vital for you to create a narrative and to live your life. All you hear are your own thoughts. All you live is your own life. Sometimes, especially in the vein I was in, which was a little bit depressed, was just like imagining a chance to maybe just try on someone else's fucking shoes, to screw someone else's brain into yours, and just to see how they might surmount the challenges you're faced with, to see how they would maybe not struggle in the ways that you are. And I just thought that would be, I guess, an interesting theme to write about. And it came really naturally, man. I wrote that in like fucking 90 minutes, and it was like, holy shit. Like, when the theme is clear and when the intent is there, or when you're suffused with enough emotion to write something, you know, it comes out. And I was pretty proud of the way it flowed anyway.
It almost, and you're not going to like this, came across as slam poetry.
That's okay. Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. It's like,
but it had the energy of that.
Yeah, like a little bit more, as opposed to pausing poetically and to give things a ring. It was almost like I was trying to bark it out. And when I wrote it, I was like, that's actually how you have
did
to
you
deliver
write it.
Did
you write it in all caps?
Yeah. How did you know? Just like scrolling like Comic Sans. I'd love to perform it. It would need that urgency. You know, it needs to grow from maybe just a certain gentle musing as to a confusion or a philosophical unsettling, and then, you know, really, really land home with like a ferocity. But yeah, that's just like, that's where my mindset is at the moment, I guess. But you know, I'm going okay. I'm going good.
Well, you know, things are changing for you now. You are going to become, you're still you, obviously, but like a different version of yourself. You're going to be moving to a different place. Yeah.
Oh,
and your life is changing, as is mine, you know, like, I'm rediscovering parts of myself that I'd forgotten about.
Long dormant, right?
And not to say that I was in any way suppressed. It wasn't like that. It was just like you change when you're around someone else for that long. You do.
Yeah, your priorities change, your attitudes change and shift. And sometimes you don't even know it's happening. It just happens so slowly and organically to the point it becomes normalcy, right? And then you get like this maybe ultimate agency back. Like you are just you now, Nick, yeah. Right? You have your own place. You know, that is, again, that's a philosophical quandary as opposed to like just your immediate physical surroundings.
Yeah, I've not lived completely on my own before.
Yeah, right. And to be fair, like, I mean, I have to preface the reading of this poem and the theme I'm talking about with saying, like, I'm a very happy person, you know, I'm very well adjusted. I've got more things on now than I ever have been. And the things I've wanted for so long, more responsibility, more opportunities to perform this podcast just as an incentive to write and as a fun project. But I think in terms of being an adult and turning 28 in a month, I think I've just been a little bit swamped with that. And I haven't been rising to the challenge as well as I maybe have had in the past. So, and sometimes when you do that and you recognize and if you're a bit self-aware, you flounder a little bit. You know, I am on the right track. I just figured I'd just be really devo for an episode and explore it. And I appreciate the opportunity.
You've got more challenges thrown at you at the moment. So spread a bit more thin. And maybe that's what it is. You've just got so many opportunities, and we should talk about those because, you know, that's important. That's exactly what we're doing on this podcast, is talking about events in Perth, and you're going to be performing at some of them.
I was in talking about the things I've actually got.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you've previously mentioned that you've been doing poetry nights at the Aardvark. What was that event called again?
So the event is called Weird in Progress.
And how frequent is that?
It's usually every couple of months. It's been quite reclusive since December. That was the last time I performed there. And that was probably maybe part of some of the, you know, the unsettled feeling I was having. I was like, why am I not performing? It's because a couple of the events that I depend upon that usually just throw gigs at me, I haven't been able to pursue.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't, you know, realized that I have that agency myself. I can go hunt them, you know, if I want to, if I have the desire, and I do. So that's coming back up at the end of May, which I'm really excited about. May 26th at the Aardvark in Fremantle. It should be really, really fun.
Well, this episode will probably come out before that event happens. But, for listeners, this event happens frequently. So, you know, just Google the Aardvark and I'm sure you'll find that event. Additionally, you said you've got another Yardstock event coming up, which we talked about in the previous episode. That was that sort of backyard show or series of backyard shows in Fremantle.
Yeah.
And now I'll be able to attend them, which is great.
Yeah, man. Honestly, it's really fun. Hey, like four different yards are like just gardens. I just volunteered up by avid Frio residents, and they're usually closely situated next to each other. And what you do is, you know, just you go from one yard to another walking together with everyone, and there's different acts on at different times throughout the day at these different places, and it's just really homegrown and really, really fun.
I'm super excited for that.
Yeah.
And then the other one is Clancy's, where you work.
Yeah.
They're talking about setting up a poetry night there, which you would be the MC of and also would perform at.
Yeah, it's fucking
sick.
You've
got stuff on your plate, you know, like that's why you're feeling this way. And then you've got the podcast, and then you're doing the recording for Frontier Media. You know, you're starting to build a bit of a career.
Yeah, and I guess like maybe I'm just really unused to it to the point of like complete depression. like just being like, oh my God, no.
I'm finding some degree of success and I'm unhappy about it.
Yeah, you know, like, and to be fair, like all my life a lot of people are like this, but you know, my own harshest critic. And what did you say?
Nothing.
I think you said an abortion.
No, I said a piece of shit.
Oh yeah, well that's true as well. Yeah, yeah. So I guess like if I hold myself to a certain standard about how I've handled things in the past and then I'm floundering now, I'm almost like harsher upon myself for doing so or failing at it, as opposed to like being a friend to myself and being like, hey dude, just chill.
I feel that.
You have a lot more on your plate now because you've deserved it.
Mm.
You know, like I've earned these things. Why am I being so self-deprecating, so self-critical? Like just you know, accept it, bro. Like, you know, you can just like, just be a friend to yourself. And I've got a beautiful missile and I'm like having a really, really lovely time. My family's really happy. I'm working more as well. I'm finally feeling like I've got some recognition for the things the work I'm putting in. Yeah. I mean, things are really looking up, you know, and I'm moving into that new place this weekend as well. So
it's all gravy.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah. I honestly was a bit wary. My apologies to the listenership, but I was a little bit wary of recording this podcast episode because I just didn't feel like I didn't have the same pep in my step. I didn't have the same.
It was a bit of a sad pony.
I was a bit of a sad pony, bro. You know what I mean? And like,
that's become canon now.
You know, and that's usually Nick's responsibility. Like, I'm usually like the one who's chipper. Buzzing. Yeah, yeah, chipper. And that's, you know, and it really irritates him. But I came in today, dour, and he was like, wow, I'm even more irritated than usual. You know what I mean? Like, sort it out.
I've been irritated. No, I just handed you some more Jacks.
And it did work. Yeah. The Jacks did work. Please, please, listenership at home, alcohol does not solve problems. But fuck me, I feel buzzing right now.
Look, you know, we could talk about this all day. We could talk about ourselves all day, obviously.
Well, this is in lieu of like an emotionally explorative essay, which I usually do, don't I? But I haven't done it for this week. I've just done a little book review, a book I really, really love. And I figure we could just talk about that.
Let's do that. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, sure, sure. The novel is called The Master and Margarita. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Tell me more.
I genuinely have not, so.
It's really whack, man. So, I mean, I'm an avid reader and I know Nick is becoming more and more on that train, but I figured I'd recommend this book to you and anyone listening because I think you would really love it, you know? And it's just a mental book, man. Like, it's maybe one of the strangest novels I've ever adored in my entire life. It's a Russian novel. It was written during the Stalinist regime in the USSR by a guy called Mikhail Bulgakov. And it was never published in his timeline, right? It was never published. It was published after his life had ended by his wife doggedly pursuing publishers. It's a very strange book insofar as it's essentially a book set in the atheistic Soviet Union run by Joseph Stalin, sort of almost like philosophically bankrupt and almost in retaliation to a populace unburdened by spirituality and they're just sort of like an uncaring void. The literal devil visits the town with his demonic entourage.
Fuck yeah.
And just causes havoc all over Moscow.
Yes.
Yeah, do you see? I knew you'd fucking, honestly, I read the blurb in Planet Books in Mount Lawley, like on Beaufort Street. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of it. And I was like, this book just sounds fucking mental. I usually buy and read books based on like their reputation. I hadn't read anything about it. And I just picked it up. And it's still to this day just one of my favorite books. And it's just the amount of things this book juggles is insane.
Sorry, how did it get discovered? Because you said it wasn't published in his time. Like, how did they find out about it?
Bulgakov was very much a friend to Stalin. Stalin appreciated his writing. But because the book has a very satirical, like a satirically comedic bent, insofar as mocking Moscow and mocking the USSR, it was suppressed during his lifetime.
I'm surprised he didn't off him. You know, he got off easy, really.
Well, yeah, dude, that was one of the things that he was lucky to avoid. A lot of people who were writing things like that were literally executed, right? Or just vanished in the middle of the night, you know?
Yeah, hectic.
Whereas he was allowed to live, but this book, his masterpiece, wasn't allowed to be published. Yeah. His wife, after his death, was the one who fought for publishing. And it was written between 1928 and 1940 and was only published in 1967. After she bullied, she was just really adamant for years to publish it. And it's considered to this day one of the greatest Russian novels ever written.
Dude, I want to read it.
Yeah, it's so good. I mean, I've got it at home, man. I should definitely read it. It's just whack. Essentially, you know, like the devil comes to town, starts causing havoc. His demonic entourage consists of a demonic hitman named Azazel, a tall, goofy illusionist named Koroviev, and a giant pistol-wielding, vodka-swilling cat named Behemoth.
What?
And all the devil is in town for. The devil's name is Voland. Which is weird because there's a character called Roland in the story I just read. His name is Voland. And all he wants to do is host a black magic show for the Moscow elites. And he tears off people's heads and he rains money down from the sky. And he shows essentially all of their principles about money and economy and I guess industry and a lack of belief and a lack of philosophy to be morally bankrupt. Like the devil was there to show them that they probably need some spiritual, like they need God. One of the strangest aspects of the novel is that there's a second or a parallel narrative and the main character is the procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate, who's the guy who famously put Jesus to death.
Yeah.
And this parallel narrative is him racked with headaches and insecurity and illness in this place. And he meets Christ and he has an appreciation for him. And Christ spiritually heals some of his sickness and he becomes like bonded to him. But he has to put him to crucifixion. And he works to rid the world of the betrayer, Judas Iscariot. Like, he's a procurator of Judea. Pontius Pilate is a friend to Jesus in the story and works to do it. And it's like a parallel between the artist and art and how the artist isn't recognized. And the master and Margarita, the actual titular characters, kind of come in towards the end of the story. The master being a parallel to the author and Margarita being a parallel to Bulgakov's own wife. And it's just a really fantastical, really surreal, really magical, dark fantasy, fucking funny journey into this like Russian underworld. And I'm just thinking, because we've explored a lot about our emotions especially my emotions in this episode, which I thought would be a change, but turns out every fucking episode's about that.
Sob.
I just figured I'd give like a little book review, because if anyone's interested in something madcap, like something fucked up, definitely seek out The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov.
Can I borrow it? Do you have it here?
I haven't brought it with me, no.
I want it.
But now you're living free, I'll deliver it down. Yeah, man.
I might just get it on the Kindle, because I've got the Kindle arm and I can lay completely flat in bed and read, and it's amazing.
All right, sweet, man. Well, yeah, there you go.
I want that. I was actually just thinking the other night, I need some sort of Divine Comedy-esque sort of story. I want something demonic and fucked, and I want something that's written like a little while ago, and that's just exactly what I need.
Like, there's things about it that you know that are maybe a little bit dry, like about the Moscow elites and how they interact and with all their I guess how all the rich people in the city would navigate its society, right? But like the real beautiful parts are the ones I know you'd love are like the stuff rooted in the occult, and like it can be really scary, this book.
Is it quite vivid in the way that these demons and Satan, dude, are tearing people apart?
Going into Voland's apartment and the doorknob is red hot. You know, and he walks in and it's steaming.
Excellent.
And it's dark and he's sitting in like this throne covered in a robe and he's like half demon, half man. And he shifts appearance and people talk about him looking one way and then looking another and next and predicting people's fates. And it all happening with this like real comic verve, which I think you'll really like.
Fuck yeah, man. I'm sold.
So yeah, anyway, just to put a capper on a really dark and depressing episode of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty, I definitely recommend it.
Excellent. I'd like to bring book reviews and any story reviews into the program, so to speak. Like that was completely off the cuff. He doesn't have notepad in front of him or anything. He just pulled that out of his ass. And
I've read it a couple of times. I tend to research everything I'm into, obsessed with. Alex has always laughed at me. She's like, dude, you have a fucking obsession every 2 weeks. And it's just like balls to the wall obsessed. And then it's just like scrapped. But yeah, man. Yeah. I guess this is part of the Stories We Love segment. So
we'd probably wrap it up now. We've been going for a while.
Holy fuck. Yeah. This is by far the longest episode.
I
really appreciate anyone listening who is
still listening.
Is still listening, yeah. And is also, I guess, just thanks for your support.
Yeah, and if you do want to support us, you can go to spinningyarnspodcast.com and you'll find a link to our Buy Me a Coffee page, stuff like that, and also all of our social media, which we've been neglecting like a motherfucker. But we're going to talk to someone who's like actually knows how to do the social medias, and they're going to give us some advice. And hopefully we're going to start growing that sort of stuff.
Because we're all right at writing and we're all right at talking, but fuck me, we're bad at promotion.
It's exhausting.
It's just hard, man.
Word of mouth promotion, great. I love talking about our podcast when we're having a pint, but jumping on Twitter or Instagram, I just can't be fucked.
It's also hard to navigate like how to even do it in the most economic sort of way and with the greatest impact. And I think we may just need someone to instruct us.
That instruction, we might start to enjoy it. And I think that that'll reflect in the content. But yeah, that's to come. A quote to finish?
Yeah, the quote I'm going to finish with is actually the most famous quote. And it's going to sound strange, but it's the most famous quote from said book, The Master and Margarita. In essence, it means that ideas, ideals, values, emotions, they can never die. They're yours forever. As soon as they're proposed, they have corporeal reality and they have a real impact. And the quote is, manuscripts don't burn.